Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. This is your host, John Semperman, with my co-host,
Tim Alshai from the Buffalo News.
Tim, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm excited today, John. I'm excited every week for all our guests. I'm a little bit nervous because we have a writer on today.
Oh, that's right. It's
funny. Much like you, I've done plenty of guest speaking gigs over the years where people will say, you know, are you ever nervous to interview anybody? And my answer is always the same. When it's a highly successful writer whose work I love, that's when I get nervous. So I'm happy to say I'm incredibly excited and maybe a little bit nervous today for S.L. Price, the author of The American Game, which is an incredible narrative nonfiction book about the sport of lacrosse.
Yeah, no, awesome guest. Can't wait to get into our interview with S.L. Price. And I've followed his work for years and years, you know, when he was really an anchor author with Sports Illustrated. I mean, he was and is the guy.
Yeah, Scott. He goes by Scott. S.L. Price is his author name, but that S is Scott. So Scott wrote dozens and dozens of cover stories for Sports Illustrated. And there's a real theme to his work, both his Sports Illustrated work and his books. And we'll get into this in the interview. But this is a writer who parachute into a place, stay for a while, for a long while in the life of that person, in the life of that place, in the life of that sport, and really connect the sport with the culture. And that is, I mean, that's very much what this program is about. That's
sure.
What Skin in the Game
sure.
is about. To me, that's what sports are about, and his writing captures it so incredibly.
Well, and his book, which really provides, you know, the history and the landscape of the great game of lacrosse, is really, you know, it's a history story, but you nailed it. It's a story of culture. I mean, this is a sport, and I would argue, the only sport that was actually founded and started on this continent.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. In a sport that has endured.
Except, of course, pickleball.
Yeah, okay. We got to throw pickleball in there, too. But for the lacrosse, I mean, it was founded over 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And in, you know, Scott's, so we'll get into that with Scott, but his book tells a story of that. And it's, you know, the tale of lacrosse, it was started by indigenous people, really follows the very tragic tale of what's happened on this continent.
Right.
Too.
Right, right. Well, if you're a fan of the great game of lacrosse, if you're a fan of history, please stay tuned for our interview coming up here in a few moments with S.L. Price. But before that, Tim, I just wanted to touch on a couple news items. First, over the last few weeks, the WNBA hosted its All-Star game, absolutely took over Indianapolis. But, you know, there is this undercurrent now of really some labor strife in the WNBA.
It is. And I'll be honest, I'm glad to see that that's happening. The women who were out on the court that day were wearing jerseys that said,
"Pay us what you owe us."
And I'm glad they're speaking out. You know, I think back, and we've got to go back over, you know, a few decades where there were labor stoppages, sometimes pushed by the owners, more often, I think, pushed by the players. And you can see what that resulted in, you know, frankly, for the owners and the players, everybody's making a heck of a lot more money, like untold amounts of money. You look at what's happening in the WNBA on the court and in the stands with all the, you know, in on TV with all these millions and millions of fans. The compensation really needs to start catching up with where, you know, with the level of the sport. So I'm glad the athletes are speaking out.
Right, right. You know, what I would just caution is the league for years lost money, right? So there are a lot of owners and a lot of investors that are saying, wait a minute, we've got to recoup everything we put into this, then we'll share more of the revenue. So I think that's going to be a little bit of the pushback. But I would agree with you that, you know, NBA players, you know, they keep about 50% of the revenues right now. WNBA is 10%. That gap absolutely has to close.
Exactly. And that's a conversation that needs to happen. I'll, you know, throw a different sport out there, and it is not a team sport, but Jessie Pegula is one of the pro women's tennis players who has spoken out and advocated for pay equity in that sport. They've done well. Now, the model is different, but this is a conversation that's been happening in women's sports for a while now. And if the WNBA can accelerate it, expose that gap, narrow that gap, and yeah, get into the tough conversations, you know, right. Is it, do you pay them a lot more now? Do you recoup your money and pay them a little more now and a lot more later? You know, these are difficult, nuanced conversations, but yeah. In fairness to everybody, they've got to happen.
Yeah. The key is they need to come to an agreement, because right now there's a lot of wind behind the sails, a lot of momentum for the league. A player strike would be extremely damaging. So I'm very optimistic that both sides will come together. I would just really encourage leadership on both sides to make sure that happens.
Yeah, as would I. And again, I think back to the various work stoppages and the, you know, the other major pro sports leagues. And I can't think of a single one where I look back and say, I'm glad that happened. The sport's better off for it. There might be an exception there, but for the most part, everybody was playing catch up afterward.
Absolutely. I think, it, you know, Major League Baseball, as well as National Hockey League, I really think it took them 2 to 3 years to recover. The other just piece of news, just for our soccer fans out there, looks like there is going to be a new home in the city of Buffalo for professional soccer.
Yeah, for our listeners out there who are not sitting where we are sitting, which is in Buffalo, New York, Buffalo is soon going to have a new pro soccer team. That team is looking for a stadium. The likely location, or at least the preferred or hoped for location, would be right in the core of downtown Buffalo. And I'm going to describe this for people who, you know, who aren't familiar. In an old district called the Cobblestone District, adjacent to, or at least near, the Buffalo Sabres arena, not too far from the Buffalo Bisons AAA baseball stadium. To me, John, that seems like a good place to put a soccer stadium, even though that stadium's not going to be used 180 nights a year like an arena might be. You do have a critical mass.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head. For any of our listeners in any market where they're looking at a new stadium development, look for infrastructure, look for complementary businesses, restaurants, bars. If Buffalo Pro Soccer can find a way to get a deal done, and what we here know is Cobblestone, which already has a neighbor with 150 events, already has restaurants, bars, I think that is the perfect location, because the infrastructure's there, the ingress, the egress, meaning people know how to get there, people know how to get away. Let's hope that that happens.
I read a great piece just a couple of days ago in the Buffalo News by you, John Simperman.
Yeah.
This was an op-ed John wrote about the location of the Buffalo Bills Stadium, which does not resemble what you were just describing. And you know, it's out on an island in a suburb, not a lot of public transportation, not a lot of other development around there. And right now you've got a couple that straddles two suburban towns. You've got both towns looking at, you know, trying to build or trying to rezone and make more development available, which you are not loving that idea.
Well, we've had guests here on Skin in the Game, Matt Kittle from SoFi. The Kroenke organization, who owns the Rams, built a phenomenal entertainment district. Gillette, Boston, phenomenal entertainment district. Those markets are 6 to 12 times the size of Buffalo. So the point is, if we're going to build another entertainment district in Buffalo, which neighborhood do you want to close?
And you made a great point in the piece, too. You know, people could point to a market that is smaller than Buffalo, which is Green Bay, Wisconsin. Because when I was reading your piece, I thought, well, John, what about Green Bay? People could point to Green Bay. And you got there and you said, well, you know, in Green Bay, Titletown is the entertainment business. You need to have one.
Exactly.
You got to have one.
Right.
And they do. It's Titletown.
Right.
But if you have a mid-sized city like Buffalo, and there's a lot of other cities out there of this size, you have one or two entertainment districts already. You've got, you know, a spattering of sports arenas or stadiums. If you start spreading yourself out too thin, you're just not going to get the people to go there. And I'm thinking of any mid-sized major league city, from Oklahoma City to Jacksonville. These are places where you have enough people to have a robust entertainment economy, but you just, you know, you can't keep building more and more and more.
Right. It just dilutes the number of people, right? So it's the same amount of people, but now they're being shared by all these different areas. And the other thing about Green Bay, Titletown is also adjacent to a 10,000-seat arena that hosts 150 events, minor league hockey, concerts, lacrosse. So there's plenty other reasons to be in Titletown.
Yeah, it's
than
that
just
critical mass
games.
That you're talking about, and right. that you want to see in downtown Buffalo with a hockey arena, a soccer stadium, a baseball field.
Right. And speaking of lacrosse, we're going to get to S.L. Price, who is the author of The American Game. Shall we have a soccer facility in the city of Buffalo? I've got a good hunch we'll see some professional lacrosse there as well. So how's that for a segue to our interview with S.L. Price?
I love it, and I'm so excited to talk to Scott. So let's bring on S.L. Price. That is up next on Skin in the Game.
I'm excited to see, like, she said this, well, he said that.
The truth will come out.
Wondering what the buzz is? What's the hot goss? Whatever it is, we're talking about it on Group Chat, your weekly connection to the unpredictable, weird, and wonderful world of pop culture. From film, music, theater to food, blockbusters, and beyond. Every week with Tiffany Bentley and her revolving panel of pop culture enthusiasts. Listen to Group Chat on Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at noon on BTPM NPR.
I'm very excited.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Skin in the Game. We're happy to welcome S.L. Price, author of The American Game, to the show. Scott, thank you for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Oh, so happy to have you. All right, we got to start with this. You have written books and articles that I would say most of our listeners are going to be well familiar with from Sports Illustrated. You have covered so many sports, and you just spent a bunch of years and hundreds of pages and hundreds of thousands of words on lacrosse. What drew your attention to the sport of lacrosse?
Well, I didn't grow up playing lacrosse. I grew up in a town that was Pop Warner football, Little League baseball, basketball, and pond hockey, and surrounded by some lacrosse where in the wealthier towns nearby, but I really had no exposure to it. And at Sports Illustrated, I, in 2006, went down to write a long story about the infamous Duke lacrosse rape case. And there's, as I'm sure you're well aware, a caricature, a cliche about the sport as being a sort of an upper class entitled white sport, that the Duke lacrosse case, in sort of its cross hatchings of exploration of themes like racism and sexism and entitlement and class, sort of gave the media and lots of commentators real grist to jump into. And in the end, of course, the three players who were accused were found to be innocent. But at the same time, when I was doing the piece, I mean, I absolutely confirmed that some pretty heinous things were said at that party. There was certainly the idea of a party of college students were able to and had the foresight and the organizational skills and the weird sort of bent to hire a stripper was not lost on anybody in the sport or out. That cliche sort of applied. But at the same time, when I was working on that, there were certain exceptions to the cliche that kept popping up that made me think, huh, maybe I'm not being exactly fair to this sport, at least in my preconception. So that stuck with me. And then in 2010, I went off and did the longest piece at the time that I'd ever written for Sports Illustrated about the then Iroquois Nationals, and spent weeks and frankly months working on a piece with Orrin Lyons and the rest of the Nationals, which are the only indigenous team recognized by an international sports body, third best team in the world. Incredible story. And of course, the Iroquois, now obviously named the Haudenosaunee, exist on the opposite end of that sort of cliche spectrum. I mean, they're not economically upper class in any way. The game is a spiritual game created 1,000 years ago to entertain the creator. And so with that exception, I'm kind of like, wait a minute. Okay, so this sport really doesn't hold water, or frankly, it's a lot more interesting than I thought it was. It's a lot more, there are a lot, many shades here that bear exploring. Other exceptions kept nibbling away at me, the rise of the women's game, the Wall Street connection, the deep connection between lacrosse and the military. It just kept adding shades and shades to it. And finally, in 2018, or earlier than that, a year or so before that, I an editor of mine in my previous book said, well, do you want to work on something else? And I said, you're not going to believe this, but this is what will not leave me alone. This game will not leave me alone. And that's essentially what took hold of me for 6 years and was a long journey and well worth it.
So Scott, hey, this is John Semperman. Thanks again for joining us. But yeah, you said you worked on this book, The American Game, for 7 years, right? I mean, is that typical of a project of yours, or was that just because you had to go so much deeper into the story?
Well, it's a combination of both. My previous book, Playing Through the Whistle, was about a town in Western Pennsylvania, Aliquippa, and that took me 6 years. This absolutely. I originally started off thinking I was going to, I went to Israel, another element that I certainly didn't expect going in when the World Championships in 2018 were held in Israel, lacrosse in Israel, pretty incongruous combination, and, you know, inherently fascinating. And I expected to write this book in time to come out before the 2022 World Championships. But of course, the big thing in there was COVID and the shutdown of sports and how the World Championships was postponed to 2023. And then in the meantime, lacrosse's quest to get into the 2028 Los Angeles Olympics sort of took hold and began to gather momentum. And with that, sort of the question of the Haudenosaunee, along with that quest, whether or not they could compete in the Olympics, it felt absolutely necessary to sort of delve deeply into that and expand the book to include at least the acceptance of the game into the Olympics, and then the question that still remains before us today, whether or not the Haudenosaunee will be able to compete in 2028.
Right. That sounds like that's going to be an additional chapter in another year or so, right?
You're trying to hurt me, is what you're saying. Yeah.
But what we're here, Skin in the Game, we host this in Western New York, Southern Ontario. So we're in one of the hotbeds of lacrosse. But in reading your book, it was interesting to me that, and I didn't know all the deep history of lacrosse, and I think many of our listeners who are traditional stick and ball fans may not know that, you know, the game, you know, was created in like an 1100 AD. When you think about that, that's 700 years before football or basketball or hockey. So that little anecdote alone, you know, shows you the depth of this sport.
And I'll add to that too, the where it was created. We're, Scott, as you know, we're sitting here in Buffalo, New York, and close to minutes, literally minutes away from Canada. It sounds like there's, you know, different versions of the where lacrosse was created, but here is one of those places, right?
Well, absolutely. I mean, look, it's essentially, as far as I could pin down, on either side of the St. Lawrence River watershed, and north or south, certainly in Ontario, certainly in upstate New York. I mean, I was with Orrin Lyons, who was an Onondaga peacemaker, famous Indigenous activist, at the Onondaga Reserve near Syracuse, and we were out to breakfast, and Orrin is poking his finger into the table like this and saying, right here is where the game was invented. So look, you can go either way. The Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy officially don't recognize the Canadian-U.S. border. So to them, it's all, this is our game, and it was created on our turf. I mean, more important to me is, unlike baseball or football, national pastime in the U.S., football, incredibly, you know, absolutely the gorilla that ate all other sports. It's gigantic. But really, this is the sport that goes back 1,000 years and comes literally out of the dirt of the continent. I mean, this is the sport that the sticks were made of hickory from trees felled. The ball was made of deerskin and stuffed with feathers. And it was created, you know, French missionaries in the 17th century saw lacrosse being played. Even then, it was the first reference that I could find referred to the game as a way to heal. So this game tracks in many ways the history of the continent like no other sport, and deeper than any other sport. And by the way, it includes the Native American element as well as African American, white, the empowerment of women in the 20th and 21st century. So this sport for me reflected a lot of cultural touchstones that no other sport could come close to, at least in the American context and certainly the North American context.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think, you know, as I mentioned in the book, all the sports that we are familiar with really in some way originated across the pond, but this is one that truly had roots, you know, here on this continent.
Absolutely. And look, the game to me, you know, the title is about the American field game, but it's, you know, there is an absolute claim. I mean, both Canada and the United States sort of have a claim that the Haudenosaunee would say, well, who stole it better? You know, so, you know, it really, the rules of the field game were formulated by a teenaged Canadian dentist named George Beers, or future dentist, and he sort of codified the rules and codified in many ways early on the sort of the marginalization of the Haudenosaunee. But the game began there, traveled down to the Northeast, quickly was picked up as a sort of elite game by elite sporting clubs, and then in the 1930s, the owners of the Canadians and the Maple Leafs wanted to fill the buildings in the off season, to fill the hockey arenas in the off seasons in the 1930s. And so basically that's the invention of box lacrosse or indoor lacrosse, which almost overnight eliminated field lacrosse as a Canadian passion and basically ceded the field game down to the United States. Canada is always the box lacrosse, indoor lacrosse champion to this day. So both sides of the border have a claim on it. And again, the Haudenosaunee kind of laugh at that and say, yeah, you have a claim on it, but this is our game.
But what I found interesting is, was it Mr. Beers really didn't even look for input from the game's creator to create that game? Is that correct?
He didn't include them in the formulation. And like I said, very quickly, one of the earliest rules of the game was, nobody could have a Native American on a team without real express permission. And that was the beginning of the sort of the marginalization. But his first exposure to the game was against Mohawks playing in Canada. But it was very much in his sort of formulation, in Beers' formulation, a way to, much like the Haudenosaunee have taken in the late 20th century and 21st century, they've used lacrosse really as their most famous vehicle for sovereignty and identity. Well, George Beers in the late 1800s was using lacrosse to say, he's saying this is a Canadian game, and he really wanted it to serve as sort of a vehicle for Canadian identity, separate from the crown. And so, no, he did not include the Native Americans in that. And in 1880, the governing body in Canada essentially banned Native American teams from playing, in that league and those championships. And which began sort of the medicine game continued to go on Native territory, but it really sort of began a fraying of the connection. The game basically sort of developed, the field game developed in Canada and then expressly in the United States without any kind of Native American input. And really, one thing I have to say, the other thing about, we talk about the entitlement of the American game and sort of the cliche of that. One thing that is extraordinary is that this is the only sporting body that in 1987 was the first and only one to admit the Native American, the Haudenosaunee, as full partners. And really, it was an extraordinary move and progressive in every sense of the word.
Scott, you make a really interesting point in the book that I want to paraphrase for our readers and then ask you to dig into. You write that, iterations of professional lacrosse have sputtered quietly for decades with annual pay topping around $60,000 for the players. And you note that, for them, the game's always been what you describe as a side hustle. And we've seen that with athletes here. What you write then is hitting the jackpot in lacrosse doesn't happen on the field. You hit a jackpot in lacrosse when you use a solid college career to line up a job where you might be behind a computer terminal for a long time, but have a decent chance to make millions. And I assume there we're talking about working on Wall Street or, in similar scenarios. When and how did the game become so elite? And I'll throw another question in there too. Why the heck hasn't professional lacrosse, caught on to this economically?
It became elite in the sort of early 20th century. And again, through these sort of like Crescent Athletic Club in Brooklyn, all white, all men. And quickly in Ivy League and elite institutions took up the game as well. And so those two sort of fed upon each other. But the fact is that this is one of the things that sort of struck me when I was doing the Duke lacrosse thing. So I'm working on that story. The district attorney was out of control, was eventually disbarred. It was, let's say, a blank show. Let's put it that way. It was in every regard. So those were things to remember. They were quite obvious. And of course, the innocence of the players who were accused is quite obvious and the lasting sort of impression. But in 2006, I was dealing with some sons of firemen, Casey Carroll and the Loftus brothers, who were playing on the Duke lacrosse team. They were the first in their families to ever go to college. So they were an exception to that cliche. And they told me, look, the recruiters who come to recruit you are saying to you, we've got this firm lined up on Wall Street. We're gonna get you a job after this. It was all about not you're going to, play out somewhere in an outdoor league that may fail or in the NLL, with a combination and maybe make 60 grand a year. It was we're gonna line you up. I mean, Yale in my research during my time had a real pipeline into Barclays, Dartmouth and Goldman Sachs. And, one of the striking figures is that, four or five dozen, more than any other sport, lacrosse players died at 9/11, in the Twin Towers, because lacrosse players were all sprinkled across Wall Street and in the financial industry. That also applied to Baltimore. I mean, there was a smaller network, but one nonetheless that absolutely was very strong and remains to this day, because Baltimore, as you know, is another hotbed of lacrosse. And Alex Brown was the original sort of investment bank in America. You know, it had a thriving network and does to this day. So when I first approached lacrosse, I thought, well, you know, it's like any other sport, right? And very quickly, I understood that, you know, you go to college and actually the NCAAs was and is remains kind of like the peak of the sport. That's when the largest amount of media attention is given. The crowds are the biggest. And then the reward is not in any way a pro career. It is this main job that you know, a career in finance. Now, I will tell you, the Premier Lacrosse League that Paul Rabil began 7 years ago, I think, actually, at this point, essentially, the big development was healthcare. Like, it actually was the first pro league to actually provide healthcare for all its players. And so that sort of tells you where pro lacrosse is and was. I mean, it is still in its nascent stage. The college games remains the ultra sort of expression of the game. And as for a pro league, it'll be interesting. You know, the PLL began as sort of a tour model, which was the teams would sort of go from spot to spot, kind of like a tennis tour or a golf tournament. But then they switched at some point to a city-based model. So they're still a work in progress. They've made great strides because of their financial backing, and their network contracts are absolutely an advance on anything else. But the stands are pretty empty.
Yeah.
For the PLL events. You don't see a lot of camera work going into the stands and really taking in big swaths of crowds. So Paul Rabil spoke often about getting the non-endemic customer, which of course is the person who doesn't grow up and love lacrosse. I mean, there are plenty of people who love the NBA who never play the game or are fascinated by it. Pro lacrosse especially still hasn't gotten that. And that's really the next step.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we're with S.L. Price. Scott is the author of The American Game, and we're talking about the history of lacrosse. But Scott, where I love we're going is now kind of the evolution. And you brought up PLL, which I believe that they merged with Major League Lacrosse to at least consolidate resources a bit, right? Is that correct?
Well, they essentially ate Major League Lacrosse. Yeah.
Okay.
Major League Lacrosse was reeling, and they had made an offer, Paul Rabil and his brother, Mike Rabil, a few years before for an extremely large amount of money, at least at the time, as the Major League Lacrosse really was teetering. And Paul Rabil was, you know, raiding the MLL for players. And so essentially already players were fleeing the MLL for the PLL. And so it was a tottering structure at that point. And then essentially the PLL sort of consumed it.
Right, right. Well, what I love to read what Paul was doing with PLL was really celebrating the history of the game, celebrating the, you know, making the game much more inclusive and really focusing on making it an approachable sport. But I think the big part was celebrating the native history of the game, almost as if maybe a little bit of a festival feel even before the game begins.
Yeah, I mean, they would have land acknowledgments, announcements. You would have at the, I remember the PLL game I attended at Hopkins, at Johns Hopkins. There was sort of this tower of a sort of a monument, so to speak, with the names of, you know, with the long statement by Lyle Thompson about the land acknowledgment. Lyle Thompson is a very famous, perhaps the greatest Haudenosaunee player of all time, two-time Tuwaratawn winner. And, you know, there was an announcement about relationship violence and just a real feeling. The game had a real progressive and, as you said, inclusive feel that really gave it a different taste. And Paul's, you know, deserves credit for that, because it really was something he's been pushing very hard. He acknowledges the Duke lacrosse rape case and the murder by George Hughley, UVA player of Yardley Love in 2010, really rocked the sport's image. It still endures to this day in a lot of people's minds. And, you know, he feels that the sport has to do a lot of work, and he himself has done a lot of work to sort of correct or edit that image in a more positive direction. And you know, it's true. Those were exceptions. They were gross exceptions. You know, there's a lot of good in the game too, and there is a lot of inclusiveness, but there are also a lot of tensions as well, and I try to go into them in this book.
Scott, a really interesting piece of the book that we alluded to earlier in our conversation is that the growth of lacrosse has really been driven by women, at least largely in the last couple of decades. Can you fill us in a little bit more about what that has looked like? And best you know, what does that look like today? Is it still the case?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the explosion of players, this is because of Title IX, the early 1970s sort of law that sort of changed the face of American sports and college sports, where the women's games, the women's sports had to be given equal amount of resources to the men's sports. And youth girls soccer took off, and it really, you know, the Women's World Cup became a phenomenon. The U.S. women's team became a phenomenon. Mia Hamm became a phenomenon. Well, the one thing about lacrosse is, again, for all its elitist sort of image, it's an incredibly democratic sport. You don't have to be 6'8". You don't have to run a 4.240. And if you're a really good athlete, you can be installed on a lacrosse field and a high-level lacrosse field pretty quickly. I had a babysitter here in D.C. who was a really good soccer player. And she was in high school, and she was playing at one of the top sports high schools in town. And she said, it's become too competitive. There's so many girls who are great at this point, and getting into a good school or even a decent school to play soccer, it's almost impossible now. It's so highly competitive. So many of my friends and me, she said, I'm going to change, are changing to lacrosse. This is in the sort of mid, you know, early 2004, 2005. So lacrosse really, really began to benefit also from Title IX. And the sports spread, I spent a lot of time on Kelly Amonte Hiller, who played at Maryland, which is the undisputed power in women's lacrosse. And Kelly Amonte Hiller went to Northwestern and became the head coach there. And very quickly, by recruiting, at one point she recruited two sisters who were just jogging by the office. I mean, she was taking anybody, but very quickly they became great defensive players and core to the whole build at Northwestern. She created essentially a power out in Northwestern that remains to this day one of the great powers in the game, one of the dynasties in the game, and created the first sort of program, Division I, to win a national championship outside the Eastern time zone. And so the game has really exploded on the women, stretched all over California, the Northwest, Florida is a power, and that's because of the women. And to this day, the women are powering this game and its growth. The men's game has not kept up nearly as much in its expansion.
Yeah, Scott, the sport really, a lot of the statistics I was looking at, you know, whereas, you know, that early 2000s women's lacrosse in general, but women specifically really exploded. There has been in the last couple of years, we're starting to see a lot of those same girls that maybe went from soccer to lacrosse are now maybe going to flag football from lacrosse. So there's competition now among these sports for these talented women.
Absolutely. And in fact, lacrosse was the fastest growing team sport in the country for about two decades. But 2018, the numbers dipped a little bit, and then COVID really kind of broke that. And you're absolutely right. There are other sports that are competing for lacrosse's piece of the apple. It has rebounded to a certain extent back to its 2018 level, but it's not growing nearly at the pace that it was. Some would say it's stagnated. And, you know, big reason is that it has now reached that sort of place where it's a costly sport. The equipment is a lot. And of course, getting on these travel teams has become all important in lacrosse, just like it is in soccer and basketball. And as a result, it is pricing people out of the sport. And it is something that the sport's aware of. There are organizations like Harlem Lacrosse or Charm City Lacrosse in Baltimore trying to get sticks into kids' hands. But there is a cost to the sport that is shutting some people out and turning them to other sports. There's no question. And flag football, I mean, it's kind of like basketball. You just need a football and you can get a game going.
And you've got the $1 million backing of the National Football League to help promote it.
Which happened around 2018, too. I mean, where the numbers, the years line up here.
Yeah, and just keep in mind that flag football also was accepted as a demonstration, as it were, or a host city sport for the 2028 Olympics. So the two sports in one sense are going to be going head to head as sort of a demonstration of, you know, the sport of the future. And it's very tough to bet against the NFL and that all that economic might.
Yeah, it sure is. John and I had Troy Vincent, the executive vice president of the National Football League, on the program last fall. And we were talking about that. I mean, it was a big goal of his to get flag football into the Olympics. Obviously, it happened. Let me ask you, Scott, the same question for lacrosse, though. How big a deal is it for the sport of lacrosse to be part of the Olympics? I know it's nice, but do you anticipate there being a tangible impact to the sport?
Well, let me just expand one previous point, which is, and it goes back to flag football. When I started writing this book in 2018, I thought, boy, here's a sport that's perfectly positioned to take advantage of the concussion crisis in football. That, you know, I wrote this book on Aliquippa, PA, which is a very tough town that really is, football is the only way out of that town. And so I was writing it during the concussion crisis, and you had, you know, four different levels of youth teams. All of them had a waiting list. And I just thought, I know so many middle-class mothers who are going to be, who you know, encase their kids in bubble wrap to go to the grocery store, you know, in their car. They're not going to send their kid to a sport or allow their kid to play a sport that where their brains are going to be scrambled. It's just you're going to see some sort of exodus from that. There was at that time a real sign of that. I think it's rebounded some. But I expected lacrosse, because you got excitable kids who like to hit and movement and hand-eye coordination, but it's not the kind of hitting that's really going to, you know, entail concussions. But what I think has happened, and you guys raised it, and it's really put the thought in my mind, football has sort of found the solution by creating flag football and backing it so that people can believe that they're enjoying the same game, but a far safer way of doing it. So that may steal a lot of lacrosse's thunder. So I think that's very interesting. As for the Olympics, this has been a long dream for lacrosse, really for at least 25 years. And the sport has grown internationally. There's no question. They've got like 95 countries at this point that are officially in world lacrosse all over the globe. But there's no question that the sports leaders believe that the Olympics is a massive boost to bring them publicity, to bring them, this is not really less known, but the IOC, you get recognized by the IOC, you start getting funding from the IOC also. So it helps financially for world lacrosse. And, you know, it will help the game continue to grow internationally, because even if the Olympic brand has taken its share of hits in the United States, especially in Europe, around the world, it's still an incredibly positive brand. And if you're attached to that brand, those rings, it's absolutely seen as a benefit for a sporting league. So it's absolutely a great victory for them. The thing about the Olympics in 2028 is that it's a one-time thing. If they want to be part of the Olympics in 2032, the Australian organizing committee would have to propose them as a sport. But that means that it has to go well in Los Angeles. So there's a lot at stake there.
What does going well look like in Los Angeles with lacrosse and the Olympics?
I mean, to be a part of the Olympics, lacrosse realized that the field game, which is sort of the center of my book, the classic field lacrosse game, could never be admitted into the and be accepted by the IOC. And that's because it's too big, too unwieldy, the games are too long, and the rosters are massive. So they invented a game called sixes. It was a really smart move. And it's 6-on-6 lacrosse, and the teams are only 10 to 12 people. The games are on a shorter field, so it looks good on TV. It's going to move very, very fast. There's not a lot of defense. Success is that going off without a hitch, but I'll bring you full circle, which is if lacrosse goes into the Olympics without the Haudenosaunee, it's not going to be a good look for the game. Both the U.S. government, and at least under Biden, and the Canadian government under Trudeau, the Canadian and U.S. lacrosse programs have all backed the idea and the cause of the Haudenosaunee to play there. The IOC so far has given no sign of budging. There are talks that are essentially going on. I mean, there are discussions with the new IOC president, Kirsty Coventry, and they're hoping to sort of change her mind. It's kind of amazing, because it would really be it makes so much sense, and the downside is so ephemeral. The IOC fears, you know, giving the idea to the Aboriginal people of Australia or the Catalans in Catalonia, you know, the idea that they should push for representation at an Olympics. The IOC would look like heroes and smart if they would admit the Haudenosaunee either as a under the Olympic flag or, and less likely, under their own flag. And I can, the one thing I can certainly predict is there would be a public relations debacle if they don't. If they don't admit the Haudenosaunee, there'll be plenty of condemnation, and that will not look good for the sport.
Before we wrap, Scott, I want to ask you a question that arcs across your work, and particularly the books you've written. And again, for the benefit of our listeners, I'm just going to briefly describe some of your books. You've written Playing Through the Whistle, which tells a story of, you know, football's relationship with the town of Aliquippa, Pennsylvania. Pitching Around Fidel, which is, you know, in subtitles, A Journey into the Heart of Cuban Sports. You wrote a great book, Heart of the Game, about minor league baseball, a topic very close to our hearts on this program, as a side note. And then Far Afield was your own, you know, your memoir about covering sports in Europe. And so with that as context, here's my question. Through your career, what have you learned about the relationship between sports and a place?
Well, that intersection between sports and a culture and a place is, to me, incredibly unique and really what has kept me attached to this area of exploration. I mean, there's something incredibly honest about sports, even with all the corruption, even with all the money, which is obviously on the field, the athletes are showing you who they are through their actions because they're under the ultimate pressure. They can't really hide who they are. There's going to be tears. There's going to be injuries. There's going to be breakdowns. There's going to be anger and rage and happiness. And it's pure, in it, at least in that regard. You really can't lie about yourself. And then you turn around and you look at the stands. People are screaming and standing of all colors, of all classes, of all income strains, although, of course, that's changing quite a bit, which is damaging to this culture. But during my time, and they're reacting to it with a purity of expression. You can't lie when you're screaming about something you love or screaming at a team you hate. You feel like these people, this game represents your community, your town, your family in a way that almost nothing else does. And so it's a strange beast, but there is something about sports that reveals plenty about, obviously, the competitors themselves, but also we who pour ourselves all our passions and our thoughts and so much time into thinking about these games, because there's something about these games that express who we are and what we want to be. Now, the Haudenosaunee, one reason I obviously focused on them was because their whole notion of identity and sovereignty and spirituality is funneled through this game of lacrosse. So I felt it a great honor whenever I've stumbled upon this. I felt it a great honor when I was given the gift of that sort of sharp proximity and openness about the culture and the game. It's been an extraordinary journey to be able to write about that. I mean, there's nothing like the Cuban attachment to sports and baseball and boxing, and it is very much an expression of the Cuban soul and heart. Same with the Haudenosaunee and lacrosse, same with many Americans in lacrosse, and same with Aliquippa with football. And for me, it's a cultural touchstone that really is without equal and in some ways has replaced a lot of other cultural institutions that have sort of been undermined or fallen away over the last 50 years.
Well, the stories are incredible, and that's, John, why we created this
program,
right? I mean, that sports, culture, people.
And it's like Scott said, it's one of the few things that can bring everyone together. Even though it's maybe just for 3 hours, it brings people together.
No, I mean, and this is at a time when religion, family, there are a lot of things that are under siege as cultural space, social clubs, bowling leagues. There are a lot of places where we come together, and this is it. And it bears exploring and it bears looking at critically.
The book is The American Game: History and Hope in the Country of Lacrosse by S.L. Price. Scott, we can't thank you enough for joining us.
I can't thank you enough for having me.
Thank you, Scott. Much appreciated.
All righty, take care.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From your morning commute to quiet evenings at home, Buffalo Toronto Public Media is always there with trusted news, inspiring stories, and timeless music. It's your connection to a world of wonder. This is Public Media.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game. Tim, what an amazing topic. What a great book. I really want to thank Scott Price for joining us here.
John, when I saw that S.L. Price wrote a book on lacrosse, I thought of a couple of things. One, he's an incredible writer, one of the best writers today, and one of the best writers of his generation. I have to admit, and I say this, you know, having had a daughter who played lacrosse and played it pretty seriously.
As did I.
Yeah.
We both had daughters played lacrosse, yeah.
And even there, I have to admit, my first reaction before I opened the book was, I wonder why I chose lacrosse. And the book's almost 600 pages once you get, you know, through the notes and the index. You know, once you crack it open and start reading it, and especially I hope this conversation we just had really answers the question of why lacrosse is worthy of this kind of study and this type of storytelling.
Yeah, I found it to be a history book, politically relevant. It's so interesting how the game of lacrosse just follows the path of North American history.
Oh, it's a real metaphor for what's happened here.
Right, and what continues to happen here. So, yeah, you know, talk about lacrosse as a way of life. I mean, this book really does depict that. When Scott talked about kind of, you know, the importance and relevancy of sport, he's written books about small towns in Western Pennsylvania, you know, Cuban Nationals, and now lacrosse. And again, as we talk about here on Skin in the Game, whether you're a fan of a sport or you're a fan of a specific team, sports is part of our community, like it or not. But it's in today's very fractured times, it's one of the few places that people can come together with a shared value. And at least for those 3 hours, drop politics and drop other debates and just focus on being together.
Agreed, completely agreed. And you said it so well, I don't even need to add to it. I want to counter it a little bit. But Scott said something that's sticking in my mind, and you know, that was about Haudenosaunee be able to play in the 2028 Olympics. And back in 2023, President Joe Biden took the step of publicly endorsing the Haudenosaunee's participation in those Los Angeles Olympics. I wonder, and I don't know that you and I can answer it, current President Trump, he has rolled back other policies that have been supportive of indigenous peoples, and it is not a priority of his. And so, not to overread the politics, but I do wonder if current U.S. politics will hinder in any way the Haudenosaunee's quest to be part of the 2028 Olympics. Take that as a real point or a rhetorical one.
Yeah, no, I think,
but it's on my mind.
You know, that's, you know, it's obviously a point of debate going forward. But what I know too about the IOC is they don't care what other people think. I mean, they are their own entity and they don't like any influences from any outsiders. It'll be really interesting. And I truly hope that the founders of this game can be represented on the field within the continent, I should say, that this sport was originated.
I say this very much acknowledging that I'm an outsider to the situation. I'm purely an observer. In my time at the Buffalo News, one of the series of stories I was enjoyed the most, found the most challenging, and was most proud to have written was a series of pieces along the U.S.-Canadian border. And I spent time in the Akwesasne community, which is part of what Scott was referring to. It's an indigenous community that, if you take the traditional U.S.-Canada border, it straddles both, and it also straddles the Ontario-Quebec border. But I can tell you, as I spent time with some of the people there, their love and passion for lacrosse and the pride they feel in their sports history in their community and with their people. There's nothing quite like it. I've never heard people speak of a sport with such reverence. It would be so powerful for the Olympics, for people watching on the world stage to see that team and play. And it would make it a better tournament too.
Absolutely.
Again, I mean, yeah. It feels like just saying it would make it a better games is diminishing how important this would be, but in terms of just being entertaining and honoring where the sport came from, it feels like the right thing to do.
Yeah, and I do think it is an important showcase in 2028 for the sport. And I'll just use really the most recent example is when the U.S. women's rugby team medaled in Paris. There was an immediate and so far a sustainable bump in women's rugby participation, especially at the youth and the high school level. So let's hope the sport of lacrosse can follow those same roadmaps.
Along those lines too, because I do think on a level smaller than flag football, but still significant, rugby has become a competitor to lacrosse for participation. And how would you characterize the disadvantage that lacrosse as a sport is at when you have flag football backed by the National Football League, trying to recruit as many young players into the sport as possible?
Yeah, well, you know, you are up against the 800-pound gorilla in the NFL. You're not going to fight them. You're not going to win a battle. But can lacrosse maybe ying when flag football is yanging? And what I mean by that is, you know, what time of year are these seasons? I think a female or male lacrosse player, those skills translate great to flag football and vice versa. So how can these sports work together and how can these athletes play multiple sports?
Oh, I have a story for you on that too. So my flag football team was playing, I don't think my players would mind me saying this, a much better team, and they're having a heck of a time with flag pulling, tackling, right? Just grabbing the flags. The two sports that we learned the players on that other team played were hockey in lacrosse, two sports where you need to make quick turns. You have to know how to deke people out with, you know, moving your shoulders one way, your hips another way. God, it was hard for them to chase down the lacrosse players.
That's a great example. And as we've talked a lot about on Skin in the Game, especially when we're talking about youth sports, is really allowing these young athletes to develop skills among multiple sports. And then, you know, maybe when they do get to that sophomore, junior year of high school, maybe that's when you might want to focus on one or two. But before that, play them all, and those skills and those friendships will all last a lifetime.
Yeah, and they're fun. And I mean, if you're having fun, we'd say this so much on this program, if you're having fun playing sports, that's good enough. Period at the end of that sentence.
That's right. So again, we want to thank Scott Price, the author of many great books, including The American Game, for joining us today on Skin in the Game. We look forward to our next conversation here on Skin in the Game.
See you next week, everybody.
This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.